Virginia Department of Social Services, Mr. Hayden, and Ms. Edwards. Is that right?
And Johns.
Okay. All right. And Johns. Thank you. All right, Mr. Hayden, do you need any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Certainly.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Hayden, and I represent the appellant, Stephen Forte, who had filed a motion to amend future child support payments in, pursuant to 16.1-241A3. It's on page 4 of the appendix. You see the motion to amend, but he initially thought a pro se motion to amend. There was only one thing he requested in there. Address the issue of future child support payments based on change in circumstance. He was a 20-year veteran of the Navy. He is honorably discharged. While he was in the Navy, he was ordered to pay $12.43 a month in support. Once he's discharged, honorably discharged,
let's get to the chase. The order that denied his motion also ended up judgment for an arrearage of $24,000+. It wasn't requested and wasn't noticed or anything else.
Exactly. That's
but
right.
But having said that, it's an order until somebody changes it.
Well, it's
was
an
that,
order.
Was that appealed?
The order was entered. It was object. The notice of appeal I filed, I actually attached a lengthy handwritten notation explaining in my thing, I'm only appealing the portion of the order that is addressing the request to mute to modify future child support payments. I indicated that there was no attempt to appeal the issue of the child support arrearage, and that wasn't an issue at all on the appeal. It clearly indicated. And I therefore said in my notice of appeal and my handwritten attachment to the notice of appeal, I'm only addressing the future support payments, not the arrearage, and therefore there's not necessary to set an appeal bond in the amount of the arrearage.
But for us to have jurisdiction over the appeal bond issue, don't you have to take issue with the setting of an arrearage in a case in which it was not noticed for the setting of an arrearage?
No. The statute indicates that no appeal bond shall be required. The 16.2-296H, and when it's read in its proper context, prohibits the setting of appeal bonds except in two narrow situations where you're asking the court to suspend the support payment, nobody's asking for that, or in a situation where you're appealing that portion of the sentence that sets an appeal bond arrearage, which we're clearly making clear the case that we did weren't appealing the arrearage. Now, the AG's brief asserts Virginia law has consistently mandated the posting of appeal bond in support cases appealed from courts of limited jurisdiction to the circuit court. I would respectfully submit that that's not the case. There are two cases that I could cite that clearly do allow that the Court of Appeals published cases by the Court of Appeals where they rule that appeals are allowed in support cases where they're not contesting the arrearage component of the case. The Sharma versus Sharma case, for example.
Your client's seeking a prospective modification.
Exactly. That's
right.
Correct.
And so he doesn't take any issue with the portion of the juvenile court, however unsolicited, that set the arrearage amount.
Right. There are separate proceedings that were pending and set for a different court date where he was the defendant in a case, and he's having to deal with that in a separate proceeding. He assigned a different case number. But this proceeding, all
what about the language on Bonk and Mahoney that talks about the unitary nature of the judgment?
Well, Mahoney is not applicable. The two key cases that they cite, the Mabee Walker case and the Mahoney case, they're cases that are being appealed under where the person appealing is the person who's been found in contempt of court under 16.1-278.16. My client is not a defendant in this proceeding. He's the petitioner. That's reflective of the fact that the court in the JDR court got confused about who's the defendant and who's the petitioner. He used a form order from the contempt of court cases where he identifies the petitioner requesting modification of support as the respondent and sets an arrearage. And so there's a clear confusion on the part of the court and then sets this appeal bond to even have the matter addressed. But the Sharma case
in Mahoney identical to your case?
No. The Mahoney case is a case that originates under 16.1-278.16, where the appellant Mahoney in that case is being charged with contempt of court for failing to pay child support. And that's the same way with the Mabee v. Walker. In fact, all the cases that I've seen where an appeal involving support is dismissed involves cases where the person seeking to appeal is a defendant on a contempt of court for non-payment of support under 16.
But under Mahoney, didn't the juvenile court interrupt judgment in $151,000+, and he chose not to appeal that and just appeal the other part of the court order?
Your Honor, I read the Mahoney case last night. My recollection of that case is, I have it here with me. I'm sitting down trying to address it on my rebuttal time. But my recollection of that case is, it's a case where originates the issue is he's a defendant and he's trying to avoid going to jail. And
he challenged a court's jurisdiction. So if the court lacked jurisdiction, then the court couldn't enter the arrearage amount. So even though he disclaimed that he was challenging the arrearage amount, by challenging the jurisdiction of the court, he was, for all practical purposes, going to knock out the arrearage amount. So what the en banc court said, as this is my recollection of the case, is functionally, while disclaiming a challenge to the arrearage amount, in fact, you are of necessity challenging that arrearage amount. But your client's in a different position.
Right. And I would just note the case I cited in the brief, the Sharma v. Sharma and Avery versus Commonwealth, where the Court of Appeals specifically recognizes in interpreting this statute, 16.1-296H, that this statute implicitly recognizes that there are orders where there's a component that may set arrearage and a component that may not set arrearage. The part that doesn't set arrearage is appealable. Otherwise, why use this language? They just say flatly, they would not use this odd phrasing, in a published case, in the Sharma case, the Court of Appeals says, appellant correctly points out that under this 16.1-296H, a judgment may have a component that requires an appeal bond, the arrearage component, and a component that does not. The provisions specifying that a bond shall be required for an appeal is that portion that establishes support arrearages and implicitly recognizes an order that sets arrearages may have a component that does not support arrearage. In such a case, an appeal bond is required only for that portion establishing the support arrearage. If the appeal does not challenge the arrearage judgment, and the support judgment is divisible from the arrearage, no appeal bond would be required. And that's what they went on to say in that case, the defendant failed to ever tell the court, I'm only challenging the modification part of it. He fails to actually apprise the court that I'm not challenging the arrearage component. They said, well, we can't assume that it's divisible, and they felt that they were so intertwined. In that case, the court, what he was appealing was an increase in his support and the the enforcement proceeding. They felt that was so intertwined they couldn't separate it out. But they recognized there are situations, there are kinds of support cases that where it can be separated out, where it's the court's properly apprised. We're only challenging the issue of whether there's been a material change in circumstances with regard to future support pay. That part's appealable. There's no need for an appeal bond. In fact, the statute, the first sentence is this very strong language. No appeal bond may be required. It's a prohibition on setting appeal bonds, except in the two narrow situations that clearly weren't applicable here. So I would submit that this is a de novo case. It's involving interpretation of a statute, so this court addresses de novo. It's a situation where we submit the trial court incorrectly interpreted the statute, latched on that second sentence of 296H that says in cases involving child support, but basically read out and failed of the sentence out of the statute, the first sentence that specifically reserves it to the two narrow situations of seeking suspension of payments or challenging the arrearage, the component part of the order challenging the arrearage. Otherwise, appeal bonds are prohibited. That is the interpretation
Mr. Hayden,
of...
Your argument, then, is that if juvenile court enters judgment on two separate issues, that it's severable and you can appeal one aspect of it but not the other.
That's correct.
So once you appeal only part of it, the part unappealed becomes a final judgment, and the other part of it becomes a nullity.
Well, for example, the part that was,
answer that first, and then you can give me an example.
The part that's not appealed remains in full force and effect. He owes the support of arrearage, and he can be confounded in contempt, locked up for that, and it's just simply, if he's not challenged in that there's just no change to the court's order there. He was found in contempt. He's put, if there's some proceeding under 16.1-2, but if he's only appealing the issue of the future modification, that's appealable. And that's what the case law, the existing case law, on published case law, the two cases I cited, clearly hold it is possible to separate it out. And when it's separated out, it's appealable and no appeal bond may be required.
And you're into your rebuttal time. You're welcome to continue.
I would ask you one thing. Even now, on page 44 in the statement of facts, the Attorney General's office concede that they're not representing the respondent. They're not acting as counsel for respondent. And that's part of the stipulated facts of the case. So I wonder whose interests are they representing here? They've never asked to intervene in the case or filed a pleading to ask to intervene. Why are they a party? Why do they have a right to speak? If they never requested in any court that they're to be made a party or be identified as counsel. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ann Johns, and I represent the Division of Child Support Enforcement. The trial court correctly ruled that they lacked jurisdiction to hear Forte's appeal because he did not perfect the appeal bond. Virginia law mandates the posting of appeal bonds in support cases appealed from courts of limited jurisdiction.
Counsel, if I might interrupt, would you agree that the juvenile court had no authority to enter up judgment for an arrearage when it was not sought, it was not in the petition, nobody asked for it?
No, Judge, I would not agree to that. What Mr. Hayden is relying on is Avery. That case is 1996, but when you look at what Avery says, it cites McCall. And that case was actually done. Appeal bonds have been mandated in Virginia since 1924.
My question is, okay, don't you have a due process problem with entering a judgment that nobody asked for there was no notice of it?
But Judge, the arrears are so intertwined in a motion to amend decrease. Yes, he's asking the court to deal with future child support payments, but the arrears are part of it. Had he gotten past the point of there's a change in circumstances, the court would have had to deal with the arrears because they would have gone back to date of service on the mother to find the effective date. The arrears are part of that, just like in Mahoney.
Can you help me with that? I mean, I understand the appellant's position to be, I don't dispute I owe money in arrears.
Correct.
And so I'm going to have to pay that. But what I am arguing is now that I'm out of the Navy, I can't find a job. I mean, rightly or wrongly, I mean, I don't know. But that's his argument. And so I'm not in a position to pay the same amount. I need a modification. Why are those two issues not severable?
Well, Judge, I think you could separate them for the 1 year in 1992 when the law said, when the law left out the second sentence of in support matters, no appeal shall be allowed. They took that second sentence out. The legislature passed 16.1107. But the following year in 1993, they moved the statutory appellate process from 16.1107 to 16.1296H, and they reinstated the mandatory bond language. And Avery is citing McCall, which is the law from 1992. So the Avery court, who's still talking about bifurcation, it's not the law in Virginia any longer. My position would be that Avery has no more precedential value in Virginia, that it was overturned by Mahoney and May versus Walker. May versus Walker, the court found that failure to post an appeal bond was a fatal jurisdictional defect. It robbed the circuit court of having jurisdiction to hear that case.
What do we make of the language that still remains in the statute that talks about the portion of an order or judgment? Because it didn't say any order or judgment establishing a support arrearage, because then that would be game over for the appellant. What do we do with that portion language? It seems to remain consistent. And, I'm talking about 16.1296H. Which suggests you can sever out certain issues. And then if you look at the appeal form that was used in this case, that I assume comes out of the standard forms, it allows you to check different boxes. On page 14 of the appendix, you can check the box that says civil support proceedings, parentheses, excluding civil contempt finding for non-payment of support. And then there's civil contempt, criminal contempt. And then in the civil contempt box, which he didn't check, says an appeal bond for the arrearage required and described below. So the form seems to be consistent with the statute. And so that's what I'm struggling with, is the argument that no, it's all intertwined and you can't separate them out.
Judge, I think you'd have to look at statutory construction. You'd have to harmonize the two sentences. And I would suggest that the way you would read that would be to read it in the following manner. Finding that the appellate or obligor is not required to post an appeal bond for that portion of the order that addresses a subject matter which is independent and unrelated to a support arrearage. However, the appellate or obligor is required to post an appeal bond in the amount of the arrearage in all support cases where an arrearage exists. If you look at Mahoney, if you look at May versus Walker, they set no appeal bond. In Sharma, it was a motion to amend. They set it at zero. In Sharma, they tried to distinguish it from May versus Walker, but this court said it's a distinction without a difference. It makes no difference. You still have to pay the appeal bond. And Mr. Hayden argues that the only cases he can find are cases where they've been found in contempt, but that's not really true. Sharma was a motion to increase. Bostick v. Wood, although it is an unpublished opinion, this court ruled it was a motion to amend very similar circumstances to 4K.
Can you help me understand why, in a situation like this one, what purpose does that appeal bond serve when he's not contesting? I mean, he expressly, if he got to circuit court and tried to contest that, I think you would argue, no, you can't do that because you expressly said you're not doing that. So what is the purpose of the bond in the scenario where he doesn't contest the amount of the arrearage?
Well, Judge, three things that the Mahoney court cited. One, the circuit court hears the case de novo. It starts over from scratch. You can't bifurcate anything, so you don't have a juvenile court order to bifurcate. It starts over.
What if I specifically note I'm only appealing one part of it? Doesn't the non-appealed part of the juvenile and domestic relations court order become final?
No, Judge, it does not. The second reason that this court cited as a purpose was also a matter of policy. An appeal bond provides assurances that any judgment that's rendered on appeal, would, if perfected, would be satisfied, and it protects the appellee against loss or damage during the time they have to wait to collect on their judgment while that case is
pending. Wouldn't the obligation be ongoing?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, it does remain ongoing. And failure to post an appeal bond, though, is a jurisdictional defect, and they cited May versus Walker. The other thing that Mr. Hayden talks about today is how the division was a party to this case. Actually, Mr. Forte is the one who originally opened a case with the division in 2011. He did close
it. Is that in our record before us? Because, I mean, obviously the department got involved at some point.
Yes.
I mean, you have other things to do. You don't just breeze in a case just for the fun of it.
Right.
I just couldn't find in the record when and why the department came in, but obviously it's in it. So if the record's inadequate on that question, then I don't know that we can do much with it. I mean, that's just my take, but I'm happy to have your response to that.
Well, Judge, the original case was heard without the division. Mr. Forte opened the case in 2011, not long after this order was entered. He closed it after a few months, and the mother reopened it. We've been in the case ever since, since 2011. Mr. Hayden argues that we were not, since he didn't notice the division, that we shouldn't have been in it. But this court has ruled in Bazemore that once the division is a party to the case, they're required, like any other responding party, to be noticed. And we should have been noticed. The court knew that it was a division case, so they put it on our docket. But I participated since the juvenile court. The only other thing I would comment on, Judge, is that in 2009, the legislature amended Virginia Code 16-1296A to include that all petitions that are appealed to circuit court shall be heard de novo. It was another attempt by this legislature to say that you could not bifurcate child support orders, that they are heard de novo because the circuit court is going to act as a court of original jurisdiction, not as an appellate court. The order from the lower court is not available, so thus bifurcation is not possible. And we would argue that, as in Mahoney and in Sharma, that Mr. Forte's arrears were so intertwined. And as in Mahoney, they were support arrearages are logically related to inherent in Mr. Mahoney's challenge to the jurisdiction of the court.
But he would not be able to, suppose he at some point along the line achieved success by showing that since he left the Navy, he's been unable to find work, his resources are dwindling, and the court actually grants him a modification. He wouldn't be able to deduct anything. I mean, he would still have to keep paying his arrearages. That wouldn't go away,
right,
even if he's successful with a modification. Am I correct?
Correct. But it would relate back to the date of service on the non-responding party. So the arrears would be addressed.
And the wife, since the husband didn't appeal the arrearage, could go in and execute on that judgment the next day.
But Judge, I would say it's not a valid, that portion of that order is not, doesn't stay, that you couldn't bifurcate and only appeal to circuit court.
Yeah, it seems to me that the key to the case on that issue is whether, in light of modifications to the statutory scheme, you can still have bifurcation, as some of our unoverruled case, I mean, their intention with later developments, whether they still remain good law. And if so, then that's one thing. And then if not, and the scheme has changed and everything goes up and there's no bifurcation, well, then, yeah, it makes perfect sense to require the bond to be posted.
Anyway. If you don't have any other questions, that'll conclude my argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden?
I did get a chance to look at the Mahoney case during my time, and I don't think I incorrectly recall it. In that case, Mahoney had a show cause under 16.1-278-16, where he was found in contempt, civil contempt of court, and the court set an arrearage of $150,000, found him in contempt of court for that and for not paying medical bills and ordered him to pay attorney's fees. He files a notice of appeal saying, well, I'm not challenging the arrearage, I just am challenging the jurisdiction of the court to act on the thing. They can't find me in contempt of court because they have no jurisdiction to act or to even set an order at all. And the Court of Appeals correctly said Mahoney's challenge to the validity of all orders entered, unquote, by the juvenile court and to the authority of the court to enter such orders necessarily and logically implicates a challenge to the subject of the orders, which was the setting of the arrearage and finding him in contempt of court. And it goes on, in this case, the order Mahoney appealed from the juvenile court established to support arrearage he owed to his former wife. Thus, Mahoney's appeal from a juvenile court's order necessarily was subject to the that was necessarily subject to a jurisdictional requirement 16.1-296H, which requires an appeal bond for that portion of an order establishing support of arrearage. So basically, he was saying, he's trying to say, distinguish it out, saying, well, I'm not just actually challenging the setting of the arrearage, I'm just challenging the jurisdiction of the court to set an arrearage and find me in contempt. But he clearly only had one issue before the court, necessarily. But this is an entirely different situation here where there's only one thing been asked for, address the issue of future support payment. That's why Mahoney doesn't apply here. And suggest that all support cases require, it creates this anomalous situation that... Thank you.
You've been beat. It's pretty emphatic. Thank you for your argument. We'll come down to Greek Council and take up the last case of the docket.